Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on the dates March 29th and 30th, 2021. Well, to some of us, it may seem like just yesterday, but 42 years have passed since the accident at Three Mile Island made real the terrifying possibility of a nuclear meltdown. The very scenario featured in the film The China Syndrome, then newly released and playing in American theaters. On March 28th, 1979, a routine maintenance procedure went wrong in reactor number 2 of the atomic power plant located in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, providing illustrative proof of the industry's inherent danger to people and its potential for catastrophic environmental damage. The federal government was halfway into its 14-year cleanup at Three Mile Island when the Soviet reactor at Chernobyl went into meltdown, eclipsing the human and ecological cost of Three Mile Island. And yet, neither of these industrial disasters stopped the proliferation of the atomic power industry in America or in the USSR or around the world. Angela Bischoff is director of the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, a, quote, small but mighty group aiming to move Ontario onto a 100% renewable path. She is, too, a longtime environmental defender whose career in the nonprofit sector spans 3 decades, 4 Canadian cities, and includes issues ranging from transportation, climate, mental health, electoral reform, and the transformation of our current fossil fuel-driven urban paradigm toward the eco-cities necessary if we're to have a future. The Alliance recently released the alert, stunning revelations about Pickering Nuclear Station safety that says, quote, there is no excuse for leaving this ticking time bomb operating for another 4 years. Angela Bischoff in the first half. And March marks, too, the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the disaster still in progress at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. One might think the stair-stepping of these 3 calamitous nuclear failures would make shutting down and removing a facility approaching its best-before date easy. But one would have to think again. In March 2011, just as Fukushima was imploding, the Vermont Yankee nuclear power station operating license was renewed, given the blessing from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to extend operations 20 years. Robbie Lepser is a New England-based documentary filmmaker whose 40-plus year catalog includes both short and long-form, critically acclaimed documentaries. Robbie Lepser and Turning the Tide on Vermont Yankee in the second half. But first, Angela Bischoff and the time bomb in Ontario's Greater Golden Horseshoe. Stick around. Welcome back to the program, Angela. It's been a long time since the last time we talked. Looking at my records, almost 15 years. I don't know how that happened, but here we are. We're both here still. Can you believe that? Well, Angela, now you're with the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, you're working on nuclear issues as well as clean air. Like Vermont Yankee, a nuclear plant down in the States, Pickering's nuclear power plant is past its retirement date. But down south, they got rid of theirs. Why did the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission grant Pickering an operational extension on the plant in Canada?
Oh, my gosh. That's the million-dollar question. It's hard to believe that they did. I mean, this is one of the world's oldest and largest nuclear stations, and it's surrounded by, you know, twice as many people as any other nuclear station on the continent. 2.2 million people within 30 kilometers. A lot of people in that evacuation zone should there ever be, God forbid, an accident. So, you know, it would never have gotten permission to be built in that location today, in the middle of Canada's largest urban center, right in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area. But it was only designed to last for 30 years, and it's now 50 years old. And They just keep getting license extensions. And the last time they got a license extension in 2018, that was to run till 2024. But now the owners, Ontario Power Generation, are already saying they want to run it till 2025. And it turns out that in their last licensing public hearing, they actually submitted faulty data. Or, you know, they didn't describe it that way, but we have since found out through Freedom of Information. The Globe and Mail did a investigative report on this. And it was stunning what they came up that the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, the CNSC, they gave them the license extension despite the fact that OPG hadn't provided accurate data around the pressure tubing. So this is a very critical component of the safety of the station, because as the nuclear station ages, these pressure tubes, and there's like miles and miles of these pressure tubes in the CANDU reactors, which all of Canada's nuclear stations use CANDU reactors, that this pressure tubing can become embrittled over time due to, you know, chemical assault and heavy pressures and radiation bombardment. And so one of the most critical testing things is they have to shut down the station and do this scraping, this scrape testing of the metals to make sure that they're strong enough to withstand the pressure. And apparently the last time they did that in preparation for their license extension, they came back with data that they claimed wasn't accurate, that they had subcontracted some company to do that work, and it came back not like they liked, and they claimed that it was faulty data, but they didn't go back and actually shut down the station and do it again and get proper data. And despite doing that, the CNSC nevertheless approved their license for 10 years, basically to run it until 2024, and then to slowly shut it down over the ensuing years. So, you know, this is just exposed in the Globe and Mail last week, and so we're sending follow-up actions. We sent one last week. We're going to do another one this week. Calling on last week was directed to the Energy Minister of Ontario, and this week it'll be directed to the president of the CNSC, calling them to shut down the station already unless they can prove to us that it is safe. And the first thing would be to do those tests, and to demand that OPG shut down until they've done those tests and proven to the public that it's safe.
Well, and that article in the Globe and Mail, that's from March 23rd, Matthew McLaren. Canada's nuclear regulator overlooked dubious data when renewing Pickering plant's license, documents show. Before we get into just what those documents show and what Mr. McLaren is talking about, can we understand who these players are? When you say the OPG, the Ontario Power Generation, who are these guys? Who runs it, and what's their provenance?
Well, it's a Crown corporation, so it's owned by me and all other citizens of Ontario, and it's, you know, the boss is the Ontario government, so the Ontario government can tell OPG what to do. But, you know, it's the two largest electricity generators in the province are OPG and Bruce Power, and they're both nuclear companies and gas companies. OPG has some water power, which is, you know, very stable and its lowest cost source of generation, which essentially subsidizes the high cost nuclear and the high emission gas generation. And so there is a whole bunch of, you know, couple of thousand nuclear engineers that work for OPG that are just, you know, it's in their best interest just to keep the stations running, pumping out as long as they can for more and more years. We've heard from Dr. Frank Greening. I was actually quoted in that article you mentioned. So he's a retired OPG nuclear researcher, and he actually, you know, he read the letters and the participated in the CNSC hearings, and he read the Globe and Mail, you know, the freedom of information stuff. And he said that he actually believes Pickering is playing Russian roulette with the Canadian public. So we own OPG. We should be able to tell it's shut down. It's a political decision. You know, the province of Ontario, electricity planning is political in this province. And the Ford government, which I called Trump of the North, you know, when he was first elected, the first thing he did was cancel 758 renewable energy projects and cancel most of the conservation programs, actually reduced their budget by 60% during a climate era, and doubled down on rebuilding all of our aging nuclear reactors. So 10 nuclear, we have 18, but they were rebuilding 10 of our aging nuclear reactors at very high cost and expense, locking us into high-cost nuclear for many more decades. And they bought up three old gas plants, and they're planning to ramp up gas 500% and, you know, turn their nose at wind and solar And also, the previous Liberal government was negotiating with Quebec to purchase very low cost renewable water power from Quebec and storage as well. And the Ford government hasn't resumed any of those negotiations either. So we have many lower cost options. In fact, we could triple the, you know, with the existing transmission lines between Ontario and Quebec, we could triple the imports of water power from Quebec from what we already do. And that would be enough to actually replace all of Pickering. So we could shut down Pickering, replace it with water power from Quebec, no transmission upgrades necessary, save billions of dollars, because we pay OPG 9.2 cents to run our aging nuclear reactors, and water power from Quebec. Quebec's offered us a price of 5 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's just total insanity to keep moving in this direction.
And what about the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission? Now, that sounds like it's a federal agency. What are the dynamics between these two government agencies?
The CNSC is essentially a rubber stamp commission. They have never turned down a license request from the nuclear industry, ever. So they just, you know, they rubber stamp whatever the industry wants. The bulk of their funding, I think it's 70%, comes from industry. So it's in their best interest to keep those stations running. And they answer to NRCan, the National Resources Canada, and the federal department. And they're also responsible for promoting nuclear power. So the regulatory agency doesn't really have much incentive to, you know, they're supposed to protect the health and safety of Canadians. That's their mandate. But, you know, as Frank Greening said, Dr. Frank Greening, they're playing Russian roulette with the Canadian public. So we don't hold out much. You know, we'll keep pushing them to follow their mandate of protecting the health and safety of Canadians. But to date, they haven't proven to really address that mandate.
Well, Dr. Frank Greening figures big in the article in the Globe and Mail, but he's also been involved with you guys in the past. In a video piece that he did, Unsafe at Any Speed, on the, you know, Pickering Nuclear Unsafe at Any Speed, from way back in 2016, he was talking about these same issues with these aging tubes that get embrittled and pose a danger. And you said there's miles and miles, but there's also hundreds and hundreds of these tubes. And Dr. Greening says in this, and is quoted by McLaren in the Globe and Mail piece, saying that, quote, the OPG can't inspect all 38 tubes in the reactors. Instead, they feed data from a small number and feed that into a mathematical model to predict safety. More than two-thirds of the tubes, he goes on to say, are never and will never be inspected. So in essence, what we're having is an algorithmic sense of reality of how safe this nuclear plant is.
Yeah. You know, we did a study a couple of years ago. We hired Dr. Ian Fairley, who, you know, looked at the Pickering Nuclear Station, which, you know, is in the center of Canada's largest urban area. And, like, think about Fukushima. That was in a rural area. And still hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated. Many tens of thousands still can't return. And they still have a serious problem of radioactivity in the forests. But imagine if an accident like that happened within the Greater Toronto Area. So we posed that question to Ian Fairley. What would a Fukushima-sized accident look like if it happened at Pickering? And he did this very extensive study. I mean, we're looking at hundreds, I forget the exact numbers, but we're talking hundreds of thousands of, let me see, there was like 30,000 cancers, of which half would be fatal. Hundreds of thousands of people would be evacuated. You know, all of Pickering would be evacuated, never to be return, or at least for 100 years. It was just like, why would we operate a very dangerous old, like I mentioned, it's one of the world's oldest. It's 50 years old, designed to last 30 years. It's now 50 years old. So why would we risk that when we have much lower cost renewable options available to us today? We could build out wind and solar, or just I mentioned importing water power from Quebec, even conservation. Like these, the whole world is moving to a renewable future. Ontario really stands alone in rebuilding our aging nukes, extending them. Even Quebec, when their CANDUs came to the end of their lives. They had two. One shut down relatively early, but the other one ran until its full 30 years. And then Hydro-Québec shut it down and said they wouldn't extend it beyond its time life. But OPG in Ontario just keeps wanting to extend it. And, you know, we've been, as a civil society organization, calling for years for it to be shut down. And, we're still trying.
Well, when one thinks about the Japanese, and the kind of preparation that the civic organization that they have for disaster response, because of their location, the earthquakes and everything else, I wonder if people in Ontario are nearly as prepared to evacuate in a single direction. When you mention Quebec, yeah, they have nuclear power. They shut down their Gentilly 2 reactor when it reached 210,000 effective full power hours. It did that because that was the spec when this was built. And they said they wouldn't even consider going further because they're worried about the life of these tubes and the embrittling that you described earlier. And yet the extension, I can't remember the number now off the top of my head, but roughly I think it's 295,000 hours that Ontario has extended it?
Yeah, they first got an extension to it was about 250 and now it's about 295. So yeah, they're just, and that's where Frank Greening is saying Russian roulette. It just, and there was another nuclear engineer, former OPG nuclear engineer as well, that was quoted in that same Globe and Mail article. His name is Dr. Sunil Nujuan, and he said that in a worst case scenario, if there was a ruptured pressure tube, that it could lead to a series of cascading failures, not unlike what happened at Fukushima. So, you know, with six reactors operating at Pickering, we really don't want to have a cascading failure like what happened at Fukushima. It's really upsetting. It's outrageous, really.
What's the big deal? Fukushima is fine today. They're going to have the Olympics there, right? So what could be wrong? If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Angela Bischoff. She has worked with the environmental nonprofit sector for more than three decades in four Canadian cities, working on issues ranging from eco-cities, transportation, climate, mental health, and elections. She's director now of the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, and it describes itself as a small but mighty group aiming to move Ontario onto a 100% renewable path. She also practices and teaches yoga, commutes by bicycle, and cares for her aging mother there. You sound like you're pretty busy, and you were very busy, and we almost didn't make this connection. And I got to reiterate how happy I am to be able to talk to you, especially after this long interim time since the last time we spoke. When we're talking about the pollution that was caused in Fukushima, Angela, you're talking about what the effect it has on people, the effect on, you know, Ontario's famous, Southern Ontario's famous farmland. But what about the lake? I've got in my hand a National Geographic from December 2020, and the issue is called Saving the Great Lakes. I was thumbing through it earlier this morning, and there's a lot of the Great Lakes are facing a lot of problems, and it goes through a lot of them. And I didn't find it might be in there. I didn't read it, you know, exhaustively, but I didn't see the mention of nuclear radiation poisoning or anything like that in this so far. What about the effects of a disaster on the lake itself?
So on Lake Ontario itself, on the Canadian side, there's 12 nuclear reactors at Darlington and Pickering, and then on Lake, and there's also several reactors on the U.S. side of Lake Ontario, and then there's in Lake Huron there's a bunch of reactors on both sides of the border, but Lake Erie doesn't have any nuclear reactors, and it's interesting. Sorry, Lake Superior. Lake Erie does have nuclear reactors, but the tritium levels in Lake Ontario are twice that the tritium levels of Lake Superior. And tritium, of course, is released from the nuclear power reactors, especially the CANDUs. They're essentially tritium production factories. And they release tritium up into the air and into the water, which is, you know, a radioactive form of hydrogen, which binds with oxygen and actually binds into the water molecule. And you can't separate it out. And that's the problem, all the tritiated water, the radioactive tritiated water at Fukushima right now, they have more than 1,000 large containers of water gathering in these large containers that they're threatening to just release into the Pacific Ocean, and the local communities and the farmers have been fighting it for years, but they don't know what to do with it because it's almost impossible to pull the tritium out, or if you pull some, you can't pull it all. Anyways, it's radioactive, and you know, people swim in Lake Ontario. Pickering itself, I mentioned, it's right in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area. It's right on a beach. It's right in the middle of Pickering. It's on the waterfront, and people swim all can swim all year round at that at the Pickering Beach, which has a playground and a nice sandy beach, because it stays warm all year round and people go there and fish and you know, do water sports on the water there because it's way warmer than the surrounding water. And that is, you know, once again, we hired Dr. Ian Fairley to do a report on the tritium releases from the Pickering Nuclear Station. He estimates, or his data collection shows him that 100 kilograms of tritiated water vapor are released every day into the air and into the water from the tritium, or from the Pickering Nuclear Station alone. And yeah, it's interesting that like international bodies don't often talk about the tritium problem and the consequences of that. They're concerned about other things like algae, but they rarely talk about tritium. So it is a really big problem. People living near the Pickering Nuclear Station, Dr. Ian Fairley said that people living within the station shouldn't eat food within 5 kilometers of the station because of the tritiated water vapor that is just released into the air and then falls near the station. And he said that women should not get pregnant and give birth within 10 kilometers of the Pickering Nuclear Station because of the tritium releases. So, you know, it's really outrageous that our health officials aren't talking about this stuff. They just want to pretend it's not happening. And, you know, kids don't learn about it. I give presentations to high school students and university students all the time. And one of the things I do is I ask them, do you know how many nuclear reactors are in the GTA, or how many nuclear stations are in Ontario? And really nobody has a clue. And most of them don't even know we have nuclear reactors, let alone that we're the second most nuclearized jurisdiction in the world with 18 nuclear reactors, 12 in the GTA and 10 working in the GTA, 12 in the GTA total, 10 of which are working. And the Bruce Nuclear Station on Lake Huron, which is just Western Ontario, that is the largest nuclear station in the world with its 8 reactors. And they've already rebuilt 2 and they're rebuilding the other 8. So, and these projects are like triple the cost of water power from Quebec, triple the cost of wind and solar. I mean, wind and solar 10 years ago was more expensive, but now it's a third of the cost of rebuilding our aging reactors. And now the Ontario government, with the support of the feds, wants to build out a whole new generation of nuclear reactors. They call them small modular reactors, SMRs, but they're not small. And they're nuclear reactors, and they're very expensive. Again, triple the price of wind, solar, and water. And they still will leave a legacy of high-level radioactive waste for, you know, untold generations in the future. Not to mention regular releases of airborne emissions, requiring mining and transport and potential danger and waste. So it's unconscionable.
This idea that this is a near zero emission industry is a bit laughable. And for those, though, that do know that there are Canada is in the nuclear game, they may know the can-do and think it's great. But according to Frank Greening, and he cites Scott Madden's report, an independent report on a comparative report on nuclear technologies, and it placed the can-do reactor technology right at the bottom, which might be why they're coming out with these small nuclear reactor technologies because what we have is so lacking. I'm concerned too, Angela, about the shutdown phase. Now, if you're successful in getting this plant shut down on its scheduled date in 2024 or before, I mean, if it isn't extended even after that again, that doesn't mean the end of things for Pickering. The stations are there, but you can't just turn these things off and walk away. What's the shutdown phase or the build down look like?
Good question. So OPG, their plan when the station eventually shuts is to let it sit idle on the waterfront for 30 years, allowing the radioactivity to release and coming up with a long-term plan for the high-level radioactive waste. I mean, we still don't have a plan what Canada is going to do with that. So they just want to push the decommissioning down the road to the next generation. They want to push off any costs as well. And then the decommissioning process, they claim, will be around 10 years. So we've been advocating for years that when the station shuts down, we should instead immediately dismantle the station and place all of the high-level nuclear waste, especially in the decommissioning waste, in above-ground, attack-resistant, reinforced concrete vaults, because at the present, all of the high-level waste is just in conventional storage buildings. So it's not in attack-resistant tanks or anything. So it's really not safe. You know, there's as much plutonium at the Pickering nuclear site as all the nuclear weapons on the world combined. So there's a heck of a lot. With those 8 reactors, they've been running since 1971. There's a lot of nuclear waste there. So we're saying manage the waste properly. And more importantly, the International Atomic Energy Agency, they have stated that international best practice is for immediate decommissioning, not letting the station sit idle for 30 years, but for safety and health, immediate dismantlement. It's also the cheapest option, like deal with it now and get the waste in safe bunkers. So that's international best practice. So we're pushing OPG to do that. And for the first time in Pickering City Council's history, we got them to also support a motion which goes counter to OPG, because they're really in the pocket of OPG because they've been supported to the tune of millions of dollars since Pickering Nuclear Station was there. So they're all buddies. But we got Pickering City Council to support our motion to immediately dismantle the station when it shuts down, claiming that it's in their best interest. They want the waterfront back as soon as possible, and it's international best practice. So OPG, I think, is really cheesed about that. But so that's an ongoing campaign that we've got going.
CleanAirAlliance.org. Go there to find out more, because you guys have a whole lot going on. Angela Bischoff, I don't know that I have 15 years left in me to wait for our next conversation. So maybe we can talk a little sooner than that.
Please do. I'd like to another show. Let's talk about gas and fossil fuels, because Ontario is the first jurisdiction in the world to start calling for a 100% coal phase out. And that, again, was our organization, the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, that began that campaign. And it only took 17 years, but we won. And, you know, the rest of the world followed Ontario's lead and is now phasing out coal. But we were the first to call for it for environmental and health reasons. And now we are the first that I know of to call for a gas plant phase out by 2030. I'm happy to say President Biden has followed our lead, and he recently has called for the phase out of all gas and coal by 2035. But, you know, we were the first to call for it, and we're going to get there sooner because we're really on a roll with this one. 22 Ontario municipalities, including the City of Toronto, have supported our call for 100% gas plant phase out by 2030 in replacement with renewable power and conservation. So, yeah.
Well, Angela, thanks for coming on the show again after so long. And we'll talk again, I'm certain, before that. And we'll follow your work. I want the rest of you guys to stick around, because Robbie Lepser is coming up, and we're going to talk about the Vermont Yankee and what a successful shutdown of a nuclear plant can look like, if only we would do it up here, too. Thanks again, Angela, for coming on, eh?
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to connect with you 15 years later, and call me anytime. Peace.
Peace out.
Peace out.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at cfuv.ca, Thursday and Saturdays, and at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago, Jakarta, Helsinki, Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Manchester, Bangalore, and somewhere in Russia I can't actually remember the name of.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded on the date March 30th, 2021. Well, March 11th marked the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the disaster still in progress at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. One might think this calamitous nuclear failure would make shutting down and removing a facility approaching its best before date easy, but one would have to think again. In March 2011, just as Fukushima was imploding, the Vermont Yankee nuclear power station's operating license was renewed, given the blessing from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to extend operations 20 years to March 2032. Robbie Lepser is a New England-based documentary filmmaker whose 40-plus year catalog includes both short and long-form critically acclaimed documentaries, from the burgeoning environmental protest movement of the 1970s to the social justice and growing global peace movements currently roiling world capitals. Lepser has chronicled the people who he says, quote, stick their necks out to take risks for grassroots social change and build bridges across cultures. His 2019 release, broadcast on Free Speech TV, Link TV, and Vermont PBS, and produced in association with NHK TV Japan, is Power Struggle. Today, Robbie Lepser and Turning the Tide on Vermont Yankee. Welcome to the program, Robbie.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Robbie, Vermont Yankee is history now, except for the cleanup, of course. Why was it so difficult to shut down this old plant?
Well, it turns out that it's very difficult to shut down any nuclear plant. The nuclear industry is very entrenched as an industry, and they fight tooth and nail, not only environmentalists, but they fight their internal whistleblowers, workers from the nuclear industry who speak out. And in Power Struggle, one of our main characters is a nuclear engineer who did work inside the nuclear industry for 20 years. His name is Arne Gunderson, and he was a top executive in a nuclear services company that was based in Connecticut in the 1990s. And when he just was doing his job to report a safety violation, he was immediately fired and blacklisted. This is how the nuclear industry treats workers. So fast forward 20 years, and now Arne is living in Vermont and is hired by the legislature of Vermont to be their watchdog on matters of relicensing the nuclear power plant in Vermont called Vermont Yankee. Citizens were opposing Vermont Yankee for the 40 years that the original license was granted for in 1972. In fact, they were protesting Vermont Yankee before construction even began and all throughout its life. And so it was really as a result of the steadfastness, the perseverance of grassroots activists over decades is why that nuclear power plant is finally shut down.
And my film Power Struggle really looks into what turned that balance, what made that difference.
You've been at this business for a long time, and this has been a very long fight. Even before, as I mentioned in the introduction, the 1979 meltdown at Three Mile Island, but the people there were opposed even before that. What was the essence of public popular opposition, or how popular was that opposition?
It was very widespread across the state of Vermont. By the time that the legislature voted, and I should explain that the Vermont legislature is very unique in that it was the only legislature in the United States that had authority to take a vote about the future operation of a nuclear power plant. And that's because Vermont is in this unique position of being the only state that requires a state license in addition to a federal license for a nuclear power plant to operate. So they had some say here, and through the legislature, through their elected officials, citizens had a voice. And that's why I got involved as a filmmaker, because when I heard that the legislature was going to take this vote, and I had no idea that I'd be filming over 5 years and no idea how the legislature would ultimately vote, how the federal government would react, how the power company would react, I thought that I could make a film that would show this process of citizens involved in an issue that affects all of our lives. In this case, not only is it the future of energy, but it's about the health and safety of our communities. Because I personally live 18 miles from Vermont Yankee, and if there was ever a major accident there that would release large amounts of radioactivity into the environment, the whole region of Western Massachusetts, Southern Vermont, Southern New Hampshire would be affected.
Vermont is famously progressive, and how indicative is the political atmosphere, especially around nuclear power, nuclear issues? How indicative is that attitude in the rest of the country?
Well, first of all, I would say Vermont is unique in that I did a lot of filming in the state legislature, and I would say that Vermont may be one of the only states in the United States where grassroots democracy actually works, and that the legislators, the state legislators, really listen to their constituents. Across the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, there's a level of civility, there's a level of really listening and inquiry and really paying attention to what citizens want. So when I was filming, I started filming in 2010, and I knew that this vote was coming up, but I didn't know exactly when. And what happened at the beginning of when I was filming, I was actually filming this march of activists from southern Vermont, from Brattleboro in the southern Vermont, 126 miles to the state capital, Montpelier. It was an 11-day walk and 126 miles. And this is the clincher. It was in the dead of winter. It was the beginning of January. And I thought, well, I'd film this to show the perseverance, show the commitment of activists to walk through the winter to make a statement, to close this dangerous old nuclear power plant down. And literally halfway through the walk, the activists hadn't even made it yet to the state capitol, was when the news was released that there was a massive leak of radioactive tritium underneath Vermont Yankee into the groundwater. And that caused a political firestorm all across Vermont, and particularly in the state legislature, because not only was the power company Entergy caught contaminating the environment with radioactivity, but they were also caught in a lie, because the year before they had testified under oath to the Vermont Public Service Board that really controls the licensing of Vermont Yankee, that there was no underground pipes carrying radioactivity. And then when the leak happened, they had to admit, well, this leak came from these underground pipes that we formally denied existed. So that, in combination with the massive citizen organizing on a grassroots level, led the Senate of Vermont to vote overwhelmingly 26-4 to not renew the state license for Vermont Yankee. Now, the story doesn't end there, because Entergy, which is the second largest nuclear power company in the United States, turned around and sued the state of Vermont to try to overrule their law that gave the legislature authority.
Yeah, we see up here in Canada, too, our system is a little different, of course, than the American one. But there is a coordination between provincial or our state governments and the federal government. What role does the federal government play in the production?
Well, it's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that oversees the safety of nuclear power plants for commercial operation. And this is where we have a giant problem here in the United States, because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is totally in bed with the nuclear industry. And as hard as citizens fight to just have the Nuclear Regulatory Commission enforce its own rules, time and time and time and time again, the citizen challenges are just ignored and are voted down and overruled in favor of watering down regulations that are supposed to protect the public interest and supposed to protect the environment. And so it's very, the activists have learned that it's very difficult to bring challenges to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on a federal level. So that's why the activists came up with a strategy of working through the state. They felt they had an opportunity to really make a difference on a state level in Vermont, and they did. They really did. And so Power Struggle really chronicles a very rare occurrence of grassroots activists, grassroots environmental activists, and grassroots anti-nuclear activists actually winning. That is a very rare thing. And I hope that this story can inspire environmental activists across the United States, across Canada, and all around the world.
Well, we certainly need it, and certainly need it up here in Canada, too. If you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Robbie Lepser. Robbie is a New England-based documentary filmmaker. His 40-plus-year catalog of films includes both short and long-form critically acclaimed documentaries. We're talking today about his 2019 release, which is broadcast on Free Speech TV, Link TV, and Vermont PBS, and produced in association with NHK TV Japan. It's Power Struggle, grassroots activists making a difference. This film, as you write, you were working on for 5 years, but you've been working on this issue for many more years than that. I was looking at some of your past films. You sent me out a package, and one of the through pieces is a really unique activist, Frances Crowe. Do you want to talk a little bit about Frances Crowe and the role that she plays in not only this film, but your other work as well?
Well, I've been living in Western Massachusetts in the Amherst, Northampton area of the Connecticut River Valley in Massachusetts for over 40 years. And Frances was one of the first activists that I met when I first came to the Valley in 1976. As a student at Hampshire College, and I immediately got involved with activism, peace activism, and anti-nuclear activism at the time. And so I met Frances immediately. She was in her late 50s at the time and had been a lifelong activist. Really, what inspired her was as soon as Hiroshima, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima happened, and she talks about this in Power Struggle, she wanted to become a peace activist. And so she's been a peace and anti-nuclear activist all of her life. I actually first filmed Frances when I was 18 and she was 58 at the birth of the anti-nuclear power movement, direct action movement in the United States, which was at Seabrook, New Hampshire in the spring of 1977, when 1,414 people were arrested and held in National Guard armories for 2 weeks. And I was there with a crew of independent filmmakers filming this really grassroots history in the making. And I interviewed Frances at Seabrook. So fast forward now 40 years, or almost 40 years, and I start filming her when she's now 93 years old, and she's part of an affinity group called the Shut It Down Affinity Group. It's all senior women, all women over 70, who are just dedicated to putting their bodies on the line. So they regularly go up to the front gates of Vermont Yankee and blockade the gates and get arrested. So I film them a month after the Fukushima triple nuclear meltdowns in Japan happened. And when that happened, it had a huge impact on the activism in Vermont, because Fukushima really showed what really could happen. 160,000 people were forcibly evacuated from their homes. And if a similar accident happened at Vermont Yankee, there'd be many hundreds of thousands of people who would have to be evacuated from New England. So they felt the call, and they went to the gates of Vermont Yankee a month after the meltdowns at Fukushima. So I have a clip here from the film that portrays Frances, where she talks about why she's opposing Vermont Yankee and how she's putting her body on the line.
We meet once a month. We have a potluck here at my house, and we figure out what we're going to do. And then we do it. Vermont Yankee is right now my focus because it's a very dangerous old nuclear power plant. And if there is an accident, it'll make this area of New England and maybe all of New England uninhabitable for generations.
You mentioned, Robbie, that about the tritium leak, and that while you were making this film, the tritium leak that occurred at Vermont Yankee, and now this second massive world-shaking event at Fukushima. Could there be a more telling example of the downside of nuclear power?
Well, what's really important about what Fukushima revealed and its connection with Vermont Yankee, and in my film Power Struggle, Arne Gunderson, the nuclear engineer, really explains this in detail. And that is the Fukushima nuclear plants and the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant in southern Vermont are the same make and model. It's called the Mark I. It's the very first generation of nuclear power plants that were built in the United States. And they have a fatal flaw. The containment structure is too small. So they're actually guaranteed to blow up in the event of a major accident like a meltdown. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States knew about this starting in the 70s, and in a report in the 80s actually confirmed it. And yet they actually wrote behind closed doors that this could spell the death of the nuclear industry if they stopped production. So they just kind of plowed on forward. And now we're all at risk. There's actually, at the time of my filming of Vermont Yankee for Power Struggle, and Arne Gunderson talks about this in the film, there was 22 other Mark I nuclear reactors operating in the United States. That number has gone down a bit because there's been several closures over the last few years, but it represented one quarter of the operating nuclear power plants in the United States are at serious risk if there's a meltdown, that they would blow up and release all of its contents of radioactivity to the environment. That's the threat here.
Well, and the immense amount of nuclear materials that are stored, spent materials that are stored at these sites is another thing. You know, it seems to me that
If I could address that.
Because at Vermont Yankee, the high-level nuclear waste, which does include plutonium, even though the plant has now been shut down since December of 2014, the high-level waste remains on the banks of the Connecticut River and will remain not only at Vermont Yankee, but every single nuclear power facility in the world because there's no place to put it. And this is the most toxic poison known to the planet. And it stays toxically poisonous for 250,000 years. 250,000 years. It's an unbelievable number. And there's no plan by the nuclear industry of how to deal with that. So this is actually a looming problem for our society. And what's interesting is that in Europe, they will go and spend the extra money for the extra thick steel walls and ability to monitor. Whereas in the United States, the U.S. corporations buy the nuclear containment canisters on the cheap with really thin steel walls and no ability to monitor. So this issue of nuclear waste is really needs to be on activist radar screens, and it's unfortunately not on most environmentalist radar screens, and not on even the climate justice movement, and it really needs to be up there along with carbon, because also with in terms of nuclear waste, there are proposals in the United States to site nuclear waste dumps in predominantly people of color communities, primarily Latino and indigenous in the southwest of the United States. So this is something that indigenous people are fighting, Latino communities are fighting, as well as all people of all backgrounds, because it's going to affect everybody.
I mean, just generally, this industry seems insulated from common sense and even rationality. It's fine, Robbie, to talk about these old technologies, and we can look back at them and shake our heads with their inadequacies. But there's a whole new generation of nuclear power plants being proposed up here in Canada. Do you think that there is a new form of nuclear energy?
Well, my understanding of the small modular reactors is that they still produce nuclear waste. This nuclear waste, again, which is dangerous and poisonous for 250,000 years. And that it's really, at this point, a myth. Because it's in theory, and it's going to take many years to really fully develop, and nuclear power is the most expensive form of energy. Solar and wind are much cheaper than nuclear power, and they're ready today. They don't need to be developed. So this is where we need to be moving our resources as a society to renewables. And stop this crazy nuclear madness.
Yeah, well, madness it is. And this is what I wonder, where we see Biden and Obama before him and Trump too, talking about a new generation of nuclear weapons as well. I'd like to understand better what the nexus is between the civilian and the military nuclear complex.
I mean, really? At the root of all of this, I feel, is that we as a society have lost a sense of the sacred. That when we see that all life is sacred, and I learned this from Native communities, when we see all life is sacred, then we can't see certain people as the other, or the earth is something to be abused and exploit it. To me, the nuclear madness is just an extension of how alienated we have become, or at least the rulers of our society have become alienated from what's most important, which is preserving life on this planet and living together as one human family.
Yeah. Well, you have another project as well as a power struggle. It's a bread and puppet theater of the possibilitarians. Tell me a bit about this film and how you hope to get it on screens or on whether small or large.
Well, I'm making the very first film in over 20 years, the first feature-length documentary about the bread and puppet theater, which is based in Vermont, but they're known all around the world. And I know that many audiences in Canada love them. They've toured throughout Canada. Many people, particularly from Quebec, come to see their performances in northern Vermont. They're based in northern Vermont every summer. They've been going for over 50 years. They were started by Peter and Elka Schumann, who founded the Bread and Puppet Theater in the 1960s, early 1960s, in New York City. And they became famous for their giant paper mache puppets that were used in street demonstrations against the Vietnam War in the 60s. And then in 1970, they moved to Vermont. And then by the mid-70s, they were living and based at a former dairy farm in northern Vermont, in what's called the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, in a small town called Glover, where there's a rolling farm fields. And they staged their performances outside in a natural amphitheater. And with these very large spectacles with large puppets and musical bands. And they really combined politics and a critique of society and from a progressive point of view and really an affirmation of activists who work for social change. And they bring this together with amazing visuals and satire and comedy. It's really quite an astounding record they have over the years of these theater productions. And then they've toured throughout the world, and they've really actually inspired many theater companies around the world to use puppetry, particularly these large puppets. Groups all around the world have incorporated this style. So this is a film, to me, that is quite hopeful. I first became inspired by Bread and Puppet when I went up to Bread and Puppet starting in the 1980s. And at that time, they were doing performances in solidarity with the struggles in Central America. And I had actually made a film about U.S. peace activists that went to Nicaragua. And so I was showing my works in progress videos in their barns during the weekend performances. So I have long had a dream that I would love to make a film about Bread and Puppet. So when my schedule was open after, you know, being able to finish the power struggle and start to get that out into the world, I approached Peter Schumann and Elke Schumann, the directors of Bread and Puppet, and they said yes to me filming. And so what I did is I did a lot of behind-the-scenes filming one summer, showing the young people from all around the world, not just the United States and not just Canada, but all around the world, who go there as apprentices, young people, to put on the productions, to work with Peter and Elke Schumann. And so it's a very inspiring and hopeful story of the power of art and creativity to make a positive statement for social change in the world.
Has this new proliferation of platforms, has this helped independents like you, especially in getting money raised?
Well, raising money is always the major challenge for myself as an independent filmmaker, making these films about grassroots activism. So, in fact, we will be launching shortly a crowdfunding campaign to complete the Bread and Puppet film. It's all been shot, and I'll be spending the next many months editing it, and we hope to release it later this year in 2021. But we need help. We do need help on a grassroots basis. So we do have a website called breadandpuppetmovie.com that people can go to see a sample of our work in progress and to support the completion of the film. And for my other films, people can go to turningtide.com, where I have all of my films based there, and people can see trailers for the films. And particularly for Power Struggle, there's a link for Power Struggle there, but you can also go to powerstrugglemovie.com. And what we've been doing very recently in terms of the technology changes that you mentioned is I've recently released or launched a national and international virtual screening tour of Power Struggle. With the new technologies now, particularly since COVID, people are now used to watching movies at home through what's called virtual cinema screenings. Independent filmmakers can also use the same technology to either work with in combination with independent theaters or even community groups, nonprofit organizations who are interested in an issue. So that's what we're doing. We're actually pairing with environmental groups, independent theaters, and some film festivals to have screenings of Power Struggle across the United States so far. But we're looking to launch virtual screenings across Canada and all around the world. We've been making connections with groups who are fighting nuclear power plants in Wales and France, in Canada, South Africa, in India, in Australia. So this technology of the internet and things being online, it makes it actually more accessible for grassroots activists to hook up with independent filmmakers like myself to use this technology as a catalyst for social change.
It's Turning Tide Films at turningtide.com is where you can go and find Robbie Lebser's work, and you can find the links to how you can help finance the next one, our Bread and Puppet. And there's still a lot of work to be done. Maybe you've got another 40 years worth of material to document yet, Robbie.
Never a dull moment. And really, you know, I do this because I feel inspired by the activists who I film. And I've dedicated my work as a documentary filmmaker to chronicle people who stick their necks out to work for social change. And it's my hope that the people I film who inspire me will inspire others. And that's why I make the films that I do.
Well, and there's never been a more important time for that. We've seen what with whistleblowers being thrown into deep, dark holes and so on. Again, the film is Power Struggle, Grassroots Activists Making a Difference. Robbie Lepser, go to turningtide.com to find out more. Thanks a lot, Robbie, for coming on and telling us a little bit about it today. And I want to also thank Angela Bischoff for coming on as well over there at the Ontario Clean Air Alliance. Thanks again, Robbie.
Thank you, Chris.